Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, after a suspected Islamist attack on football fans kills and injures dozens, Nigerians heap blame on their government.
The government had been responsible for this because, you know, we are football fanatics in this part of the world. Everybody wants to see the World Cup, and they should have been a plan.
And a celebrated novelist tells us about husbands and wives in his home country of Kenya.
If she wants him to have a car where he hasn't even got a salary to buy a bicycle, then he has a problem.
Do stay with us for the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
Fourteen people were killed and 26 injured when a bomb exploded at a public viewing site for FIFA World Cup fans in Damaturu in Yobe State in northeast Nigeria. The incident appeared to confirm earlier fears that such locations could be a target for the militant Islamist sect Boko Haram. Some parts of Nigeria have ordered the closure of viewing sites because of insufficient security. From Lagos, Sam Olukoya reports.
This is a typical football viewing center in Nigeria. Viewing centers in Nigeria are usually overcrowded with enthusiastic football fans. For a group like the Islamic sect Boko Haram, which normally targets crowded places for bomb attacks, the centers are ideal, especially during the World Cup season. Football enthusiast Mayowa Adebola says the frequent power failure in the country contributed to the large crowd in the viewing centers because many people lack power to watch the matches at home.
And partially, we can say as well, the government had been responsible for this because, you know, we are football fanatics in this part of the world. Everybody wants to see the World Cup. And they should have been a plan that during, even if they won't give us electricity for other days, during this period of the World Cup, there should be electricity for people to see the matches. So they won't just go and to the viewing center where this group targets.
Before the World Cup commenced, the police asked those who operate football viewing centers to step up security because they are potential targets for terrorists. Benedict Okorie, who operates a viewing center in Lagos, says he's taking the police warning seriously.
Well, my plan before was to install CCTV camera here. So I'm still thinking towards that to do it. But if there's any other thing we can suggest for us to use, because this place is a public place, it's easier for kind of that kind of thing to happen. Anything we can do to secure the place, you can suggest for us. I think that would be better.
In the wake of the bomb blast at the viewing centers in Damaturu, the police has ordered all viewing centers in Yobe State to close down. It is unclear how many more states will ban football viewing centers, which provides employment for several thousand Nigerians. Many operators like Mayowa Oduyemi are angry about their closures.
Why not leave us alone? We make our own legitimate money from viewing centers. I pay taxes. I have a family to feed. The government, don't kill us. You can't provide jobs. We've provided jobs for ourselves.
It remains a matter of debate as to whether Nigerians who have invested in legitimate businesses should be made to close down such businesses because of the government's inability to provide adequate security.
And we'll be asking you to join in that debate later in the programme. Sam Olukoya reporting. John Campbell is the Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He's also a former United States ambassador to Nigeria, and I asked him why the Nigerian authorities were unable to provide security for football fans wanting to watch a match in a public place.
Nigeria is a huge country. Its military and police services are relatively weak and very dispersed. It is difficult for the state to provide security for schools in the north, for churches, for mosques where the imams are hostile to Boko Haram, to say nothing of a relatively exposed facility like watching a football match.
Because of the international publicity surrounding the kidnapping of the 200 schoolgirls, Nigeria was forced to accept help in the search for them from your country, the United States, from Britain, France and Israel. The girls are still in captivity. So what has that foreign assistance achieved so far?
The first point that I would make is that the foreign assistance is really only at the margins. Finding the kidnapped schoolgirls has to be primarily a Nigerian responsibility. It's only Nigerians that have the cultural understanding that would make it possible to find the kidnapping victims, who presumably are now dispersed over a very large area.
Is the United States about to intensify its cooperation with Nigeria on security?
Cooperation with Nigeria on security has to be a two-way street. There are conversations underway. There's an interagency team presently in Abuja consulting with the Nigerian government on what the Nigerian government might want and what we might be able to provide.
The United States is going to spend $6 million on an anti-militant 24-hour satellite television channel. Can television really be an effective weapon against Boko Haram and other terrorist groups?
Over the long term, yes. And in fact, there is more access to television in northern Nigeria than one might have thought. Very often in villages, there will be a set run by a generator, which the local villagers pay a small amount of money to watch. So yes, over the long term, it can certainly help.
Despite growing international condemnation of Boko Haram and support for Nigeria from foreign governments, the group still seems to be able to kill and maim with impunity. Isn't the international community failing the victims?
It would seem to me that the primary responsibility for provision of security in Nigeria rests with the Nigerian government, not with the international community.
Former United States Ambassador to Nigeria, John Campbell.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
Somalia's Al-Shabaab rebels reiterated their claim on Wednesday that they were behind two consecutive killing sprees in Kenya's coastal region, which claimed the lives of at least 60 people. Kenya has had troops in Somalia since 2011 as part of the African Union Intervention Force, which is in the country to support the beleaguered central government in Mogadishu. Laura Hammond is a senior lecturer in development studies at SOAS, University of London. I began by asking her how successful those troops had been in fighting Al-Shabaab in Somalia.
Well, they have been key in terms of being able to drive Al-Shabaab out of some of the main urban areas of the southern part of the country, in particular the port city of Kismayo. So they've been successful in helping the new Somali government to establish an administration in areas, so-called liberated areas. But what they've succeeded in doing only is pushing Al-Shabaab out of some areas and into other areas. So they certainly haven't had very much success in terms of actually defeating the movement.
But Al-Shabaab are nonetheless seeking to punish Kenya for what they're doing in Somalia.
Sure. I mean, Al-Shabaab sees Kenya as a major component in the AMISOM force. They see their support for the AMISOM force as being key to them losing their control over the Kismayo port in particular, which was their main source of revenue. But Al-Shabaab has tried to cast this conflict inside Somalia as part of a wider campaign against Muslims more generally, and particularly in East Africa. And so these attacks have been framed in the sort of line of trying to sort of make the point that an attack on Somalia is an attack on all Muslims, and that they're starting to bring the conflict out into Kenya to make it one of sort of Christian against Muslim.
Do you see this conflict persisting more or less indefinitely, or is the tide beginning to turn against al-Shabaab?
Unfortunately, I don't see a tidal change anytime in the near future. I think that there's an escalation going on. So I think that what al-Shabaab is seeking to do is to prey upon some of the cleavages that already exist within Kenyan society between different ethnic groups, between different religious groups, and we'll see that kind of tension escalate in a very dangerous way in the coming months.
Now, Kenyan police have arrested several suspects in connection with the twin killings on the Kenyan coast. Where do you see that leading?
Well, there's an interesting sort of debate going on. I mean, I know that al-Shabaab has taken responsibility for this series of attacks, but the Kenyan president has said that he rejects al-Shabaab's claim of responsibility and instead thinks that there's a more of an internal Kenya power play going on between different ethnicities. So the question of exactly how accountability will be played out, whether, you know, the extent to which those who have been arrested and will be charged with involvement in this crime, you know, who they turn out to be and who they turn out to represent, will have quite a lot to do with how the Kenyan state and Kenyan society react to these kinds of attacks if they occur in the future.
It seems, doesn't it, that the Kenyan president is blaming his political opponents. Why is he doing this?
First of all, to say that the areas that have been attacked were predominantly Kikuyu communities, and that is the ethnic group that the president comes from. So he's sort of casting it as an attack on his own people, if you like, which is a very dangerous game to play, because then you have a sort of retribution that goes on and a sort of escalation of ethnic tensions, which in Kenya can be a very dangerous thing. But I probably would disagree. I think that al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility, and we have every reason to think that, in fact, they were behind this attack. There's some grain of truth to President Kenyatta's position, which is to say that this increasing destabilization incidences within Kenya are not really just about the export of terror from Somalia into Kenya, but it's about cracks within the Kenyan society that allow this kind of attacks to take place.
But isn't he playing with fire by trying to shift the blame away from al-Shabaab?
He is, absolutely. He's, in effect, probably playing in something that is potentially much more dangerous. The dissolution of Kenya would be disastrous for, certainly for the country, but for the region as well. And, you know, sort of the most extreme interpretations of what he's saying are that this is just fomenting a kind of support for greater ethnic tensions, and that could ultimately have a violent outcome. So absolutely, it's a very dangerous game to play. There's a concern that if this kind of rhetoric continues, that it could take a very violent turn. But the point is, I think, also needs to be made that the repeated kinds of violent episodes that we've seen inside Kenya are also a problem, an internal problem that belongs as much to Kenya as it does to its neighbors.
What do the Kenyan authorities need to do if they're going to get on top of this problem?
I think they need to look very carefully at some of the grievances that are being expressed. I mean, hidden within the awful terrorist tactics and strategies are some real concerns about the extent to which land, for instance, has been appropriated away from coastal communities by people who have moved into those coastal communities from other areas, the extent to which religious tolerance and ethnic tolerance is practiced within the country, the attitude towards Somali citizens of Kenya, many of whom are Kenyan Somali citizens, but as well the refugee population, which has fled away from al-Shabaab into Kenya looking for a safe place to receive refuge, and now in some ways are being scapegoated as being associated with that movement. So there's a real kind of internal kind of inventory that needs to take place, or a kind of accounting that needs to take place before I think any significant and meaningful progress can be made in the fight against terror.
Laura Hammond from SOAS, University of London.
Behind the headlines.
Parents in Rwanda are worried by a new trend in their daughters' choice of contraceptives. The fear is that young Rwandan girls are far more concerned about not getting pregnant than about not contracting HIV, which from a medical standpoint is generally far more serious. From Kigali, Flora Kaitezi takes up the story.
This is Chimisagara Youth Center in Kigali. A supervisor at the HIV Visitee Service at this center, Claire Benerugo, tells me that many young people prefer to use condoms as the primary form of contraceptive. But since the year began, there has been a new trend. About 60 unmarried girls have approached the center seeking a different type of contraceptive, such as pills and injections.
We give them a referral and give them a prescription indicating that she is seeking contraceptive services, but we have to advise them of the risks involved, such as HIV contraction, and then send them to the health centers.
Kabusunzu Health Center is located about 5 kilometers away from Chimisagara Youth Center, and this is where most youth with advisory slips from the youth center go to in order to get the contraceptive services they need. Alphonsine Kairanga, who heads the family planning department at the center, confirms that indeed the number of girls openly seeking alternative contraceptive methods has increased.
Unmarried girls tell us that they want to prevent unwanted pregnancies. Most of them are students and don't want to get pregnant while still in school.
Finding girls who can freely tell you that they use contraceptives is not an easy task, since many find sexual matters too private to discuss. Agnes, not her real name, is 25 years old and uses contraceptives as a means of keeping away unwanted pregnancies.
I go to hospital and have the injection or take the pills because I'm not ready to have a child. So, like other girls, we do it to avoid unwanted pregnancies.
This new trend has sparked a raging debate, especially amongst parents, as many believe that girls will continually be lured into irresponsible sexual behavior and insist that girls should only use contraceptives to plan their families once they are married. Angelique Ngabire is a mother of two. She believes that girls are increasingly becoming afraid of unwanted pregnancies rather than contracting diseases such as HIV.
I think young people get carried away and forget the risks, such as diseases. There should be a balance, even though they are advised about the risks at the health centres, but it's we, the parents, who deal with the consequences of their actions. If they get pregnant while they are still young, we deal with it. Worse still, if they contract diseases, we deal with it. Many of them are young. In school, they have no money, so it's us who deal with the consequences.
Pressure is now mounting on family planning associations to increase efforts in educating youth about family planning methods and all involved risk factors, especially for unmarried youth.
Flora Kaitezi reporting from Kigali.
Harare, Nairobi, or Abuja. Africa Link correspondents reporting for you from wherever the story breaks.
Meja Mwangi is one of Kenya's leading literary figures. His first novel, Kill Me Quick, made a big impact when it was first published in 1973. The following year, it received the Jomo Kenyatta Prize for Literature. Rather more recently, the celebrated and prolific novelist was in Cologne for the publication of the German translation of his latest book, Rafiki. Our reporter Victoria Engels caught up with him and asked him why he had never written a book in Kiswahili.
That is something I've thought about many times, because I really like to read books in Kiswahili and wished I could write one like them. But I'll be the first to recognize my own weaknesses. It wouldn't flow the same way it flows in English. I would have to work very hard and maybe resort to using a dictionary to find some words which I think in the end will not be appropriate. So I don't see myself writing a novel in Kiswahili.
Your current book, Rafiki, yes, you actually dedicated to the people who live in Nanyuki. And I would be interested in the question what their reactions were.
Well, they have not read it yet. It will be out at the end of this month. I'm also looking forward to seeing what the reaction will be. I hope it will be a positive one, because I try to be as nice to them, because I see myself as one of them. So I can't wait for them to see what they will think.
Rafiki is constantly under the pressure of having to prove that he is a proper man, a real man. Do you see young men in Kenya face a similar problem to this social pressure on them?
Oh yes, I would say young men in Kenya have even a bigger problem than Rafiki. You see, Rafiki is married and he's got children and his wife puts him under pressure, but sort of kind of pressure to be expected. But the young people now, they're under pressure to get even married because sometimes, not all of them, but at a certain level of education and professionalism, the girls may be more qualified than they are, so that they've got this psychological pressure on themselves. And the girls may be more demanding, so they got that problem as well. And the girls may make conditions like, you have to match up to me to be better than your real man. But that's not to say the problem is not there across the whole society, because traditionally, the man was the provider. That still remains a tradition. A man has still to prove himself that he's a man. But how much pressure he gets depends on his wife's expectation. If she wants him to have a car where he hasn't even got a salary to buy a bicycle, then he has a problem.
In almost every book, your main character is male. Could you imagine to write a book about a female heroine?
I have actually done one where the main character is a woman. It's called The Last Plague. Yeah, that one I have done where the main character is a woman. Yes, I could imagine to do more. My problem would be, again, I don't think I know enough about being a woman to represent women in a heroine or in the main character. But I'll give it a shot. I did it in Crossroads. I'll try it again.
Kenyan novelist Meja Mwangi talking to Victoria Engels in Cologne here in Germany.
Opinion.
Suspected militants from the Islamist sect Boko Haram have struck at a viewing site in northern Nigeria, killing and injuring dozens of football fans who were watching the FIFA World Cup. Users posting on Deutsche Welle's Facebook page in the Hausa language are saying these viewing sites should be closed down. But, as was mentioned in our report from Lagos earlier in the programme, is it fair to ask viewing site operators to close their businesses down because the government can't provide adequate security?
Why not leave us alone? We make our own legitimate money from viewing centres. I pay taxes. I have a family to feed.
A thorny moral problem. Or perhaps not. Let us know what you think in a text message to country code 49 160 957 5950, an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or in a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany.
Listen to Africa Link where and when you want. Subscribe to our podcast and you will get the latest edition sent to you. Log on to mediacenter.dw.de/English/podcasts and look out for the Africa Link podcast. Africa Link, bringing you the story where and when you want it.
And there we almost come to the end of our programme. A reminder of our main stories. At least 14 football fans watching the FIFA World Cup were killed in the town of Damaturu in northern Yobe State on Tuesday in Nigeria in a suicide bomb attack on a viewing site. We've also been looking at Kenya's participation in the AU intervention force in Somalia and hearing about parental worries over contraception in Rwanda. Do join us again at the same time tomorrow when, among other things, you'll be able to catch up with the Crossroads generation. That email address for your comments is feedback.africa@dw.de. Feedback.africa@dw.de. Until the next time, thank you for listening. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.